My recollection is that that name, industrial school, industrial in the name, when they come out of the outlook and belief and perspective of those days where these children who invariably came up with the working class and they fell off of the law for whatever reason, given the outlook and values and standards of that time, were perceived as that they can probably get cured or made brought back to society by giving them an industry, giving a job to an industry. So it would be largely be, you know, carpentry, masonry, something to do with their hand. They were not seen as being intellectually capable of doing more, otherwise they would not have fallen into that system and that trouble in the first place. So I think it reflected antiquated outlook. But that obviously has changed because now we're here, they're doing academic subjects. So the name does not really reflect the purpose of the school anymore.
You and I would have come in contact with some years ago with some of the past students of the government industrial school in the area of entertainment. Some of them turned out to be some of the most profound entertainers in Barbados. Some of them turned out to be some of the most profound musicians in Barbados. And this is what they were taught at that school.
Go ahead. But there was not an area of where I had a secret admiration. My mother would have been shocked. Hear me say this, for a Dodge boy. When you were playing cricket, or pitching marbles, or trying to, as you say, lick down using a galloper. If you had great accuracy, imagine you put that rock on that ball like a Dodge boy, or you knocked on that bird with a galloper like a Dodge boy, because they were supposed to be good at those things. So make a pet like a Dodge boy, or throw a Dodge boy, man. You were a giant in your field. And I admire the skills that you were supposed to exemplify because of the way they were, that was the stereotype you have of them. That was not all, but that was the name that went. The positive aspect of that school was the ability to do certain things with your hands. Okay.
Well, I'm here to be taught, but I was all confused of the role, but you just explained it, of the Ministry of Education. I found that the word industrial in there meant that the most of the students were geared to be taught industrial subjects, like how the Ministry of Education did in 1952. The secondary schools had an industrial arm, whether it was Dan Smith, whether it was carpentry, whether it was whatever it was, but for some reason or another, out of content now.
But don't forget, the government industrial school, the one was set up in 1883 or something, early 1900s, long before 1952. So that would have reflected the thinking of the power brokers and the power or the decision maker of the day that saved the children from criminality by making them industrial people could do something for the society. Thank you, Mark. Good talking to you as usual.
Bless.
Thank you. Brastas, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you, Mr. Murray?
I am good. And you, sir?
I make sure I say morning. I don't want to say afternoon for you to tell me I sound hungry like Mark as well.
I was also reflecting my feelings.
Mr. Mark, like he's running down the pot. He's running down the pot today.
Watch pot bowl slowly.
That's right.
So if you watch it too long, you will take longer to get to you.
That's right. No.
Yeah, go ahead. Yes, sir.
I want to ask you a question as a former minister, former parliamentarian. Does the industrial girls' school has a hair salon there where they can teach some of these girls to be skillful with hair and nails and that type of stuff there? The reason why I ask you that is these girls, we know they've been up there for other reasons and, you know, some sort of punishment, right? But on the other hand, what I'm saying is that some of these girls could come out if taught while up there, you know, or do courses up there in the same hairdressing and so on, along with a little department where they can do the practical, you know. Some of these girls could come out of that industry industrial school and meet some of the most top class hairdressers in the city. You know,
that's true. I agree with that. I think because of the lack of information as to the inner workings of this institution for very, very many years, we know very little about what goes on there. So I don't want to speculate, but perhaps this provision already exists and people are exposed to these courses.
So those
who know better can come in and enlighten us and open our eyes to what's going on there now.
If it's not so, I hope that they will consider strongly, because it's a place for girls, right? You know, strongly putting one of those little rooms, you know, and you have an examiner there to teach them and so on, and let those girls come out and be a good, skillful hairdresser or nail technician or something.
Or whatever else they might want to be. Let us not stereotype and predict and judge people and say that this is all they're good for. There might be people that want to do other things, so don't let us prejudge that these are what you should be able to deal with it over time and train them along the strengths and ambitions to make sure their ambitions are realized wherever possible.
I also agree with Mark, Mark thought that they were taught industrial subjects. I myself thought that they were taught industrial subjects as well. I am going to be more explicit than Mark. I think that they should be taught industrial subjects as well, because some of these girls, they get up there for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, and I don't see why it should be a problem.
If girls or boys go to school, I think I'm at 18 years old, right?
Yes.
You are trying to pigeonhole them and put them in a route with at 13 or 14, going up there, 15, at a troubled state. They might have not settled. They're not sure about where they want to be. They're still evolving. When I was 18, I didn't know what I wanted to be yet in life.
Most
right? So if you prejudge them and pigeonhole and put them on a train track, which they can't get off, you'll be doing it in just let them be educated, let them be evolved, let them be monitored and see, and point them in the direction where they can go, where in time to come, they can realize their true ambition rather than you trying to decide what they should be at the end of the day.
Okay. Right? All right. My next point, Mr. Yes, Murray, sure, on Saturday night, did you watch the Mage talent show on Saturday night?
I think that was Sunday night.
Sorry. Did you watch it?
You mixing it up with Star Wars Party, because you have some good times.
I don't want to talk about Star Wars Party. I saw we can go out without coming on. I saw we can go out rather than Star Wars.
All right.
The Mage. Let me talk about something that nicer. The Mage.
Make it quick. Otherwise, you might want to come back. We have to take a break. You can either hold on and we come back to it.
Yes.
After it. All right. We have to take a break for the regional roundup and other news items. This is Brass Tacks. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Brass Tacks. Our call number is 434-1790. Before I go to the caller who had been holding for us and is still there, I hope, I'd just like to say that we got a call saying that there's a horse running out of control on the road in Berea St. Philip, and it's causing concern and possible danger to themselves as well as people and property. And therefore, any of the authorities who might be able to intervene and solve that situation, it would be greatly appreciated by the residents of Bel Air Road, St. Philip, where a horse is on the loose, so to speak. Are you there, sir?
Yes, Mr.
Just say Glenn, then, if you can.
Mr. Glenn. Okay. Apparently, it let us know the horse itself want the garrison to open back up in our man. The horse wants to run. Miss Marley has to do something, man. She has to do something, boy. The horse is telling her, open up the racetrack. But anyhow, mister.
Yeah.
You go ahead.
You were making a point about the Babes to the World show?
No, Mr. Glenn, Mr. Marie. I asked myself Sunday night, what judges really does be looking for when it comes to these shows. The reason why I say that, how on this earth can you overlook the first girl that sing? I think her name's Anna. The girl with the highest complexion of the four of the girls, Anna. Then Sydney and Rebecca. I mean, three of those voices are golden voices. And to overlook the three of them, I remember the album used a comment to the first girl, Anna. She's the one I had to win it, actually. It could have gone anywhere between, it could have gone 1, 2, 3 between the three names I mentioned. But Anna, I tip her, he had her as number one. And the only criticism the Armand used towards her was, I had a problem with her breathing. Okay, if you have a problem, I got a problem with that. But I don't.
I missed that. Yeah, like he said he had a problem with what?
With her breathing. He found that her was a little problem.
Fair enough, right.
But that tells you that her voice was sweet. And I think he said she has a beautiful voice. Now, that is something that she could have worked on. You know, that is something she could have worked on. I mean, come on, a golden voice like that, and you overlook that.
I believe the judges, they announce criteria and the amount of marks that will go to each category. And they believe the judges, they could not see any developmental role there. Their role as judge with integrity and fairness and objective, so you judge a person on the performance all the time, not on their potential 10 years from now.
No, Mr. Murray.
If there was a breathing problem, then you can't assume that next year it won't be a breathing problem. Therefore, should we go?
But they can't assume so that by the next, but that by when the center abroad, that she can't get it polished up. She has enough time to get it polished.
But they're playing cricket. If you hit a man at a certain point in the middle of the stumps, he's either LBW or he's not. You can't say, well, if the ball had gone outside the off somewhere, he would not have been. You have to judge by what has happened on the day, on the time, on the pitch, on the chair, on the show. And the lineup to me, how the people came to me, I presume people drew for places.
I believe so.
I would like to think so. That's not normally how it goes. You draw for a position. But it's a competition. It's not a show where you're managing the repertoire. You're running order. You're managing the content. I think if you had to draw for their positions, you go with whatever position you draw them.
The lady that won, Mr. Murray, the lady that won, she doesn't have a bad voice. She doesn't
she
have
has
a bad
ex-
voice.
She has an excellent voice.
An excellent voice. But to me, Anna's voice is sweeter, Rebecca's voice is sweeter, and Cindy's voice is sweeter. But another thing I want to ask you, Mr. Murray.
But before you go, you realize that it's all subjective. It's what we think and what we feel and what we judge and what conclusion we can bring. It is subjective. So there is room for disagreement as long as there is as long as there are subjective factors involved. Sorry.
All right. My last point. I can move off that show business to another time. Another time I'll get back to you about that. But my last point, Mr. Murray, I am quite happy to heard in your news break just now that the government is going to look at an increase at the minimum wages in Barbados. Uh-huh. And Mr. Murray, I hope that they are serious and take up this one very serious. Because Mr. Murray, the cost of living in Barbados today, I can get bite for saying this here. For saying this here now, but I don't mind. I strongly believe no one in Barbados with the cost of living we got in Barbados right now should be going home with no less than $400. Typical example, 2 weeks ago, me and my sister went into a certain supermarket in the Black Rock area. We look at a tomato. She had to put the back down, I put the back down. One tomato, Mr. Murray, $4 and change. And you know the amazing thing about it? The tomato was not a lovely tomato, Mr. Murray. You know what I mean? $4 and change. How could you expect someone to carry on $200 a week, two something a week, in this type of high cost living? They need to really stop talking and do something about it.
But you realize you did, you use the ultimate power and weapon at your choice. You choose not to buy it. I'm not justifying cost, but the point is that you have to attack both the wage and the cost of living prices. And I think I did hear the Prime Minister indicate that they will be keeping a close eye and seeking to do something about the question of prices in Barbados.
Terrible. Very, very, very terrible. I'm not just prices. And Mr. Maria, remember as a little boy, years ago, we had what you call the shop inspectors. We used to go around to the shops and keep the shops under control. When they say shops, I mean them supermarkets, everybody, keep them under control. Today now, you don't see these guys.
Because you use the very important word of control. That was when there was a whole regime of prices, of price control in Barbados.
But who,
and therefore, they had to be on
that mark. Government needs to put that mark.
My friend, one of the reasons that was changed in the 1970s, I think Tom Adams did a lot to demolish that, because it was found that when you had tight price controls, it limited competition among people, importers and vendors, because the markup was so little. So people were going to the same source to get the goods. But when and this came out of the energy crisis in 1973-74, where inflation took off and prices, Bradford Tate was Minister of Trade and Industry at that time. And virtually every other night used to be on TV announcing an increase in that by a penny and 4 cents going down with it. And it became very tiresome. And once the controls were removed on most items, competition soared. You had more people importing, they were importing from other new sources, because people then source other stores and sell at their price, let it compete, let the buying public. He said, you remember one classic example was something to do with corned beef. Corned beef experienced a tremendous drop. I think corned beef was probably about $3 or $4 a tin in those days when that would have been a lot of money. But once the market was opened up to competition, believing that made a lot of difference eventually in the reduction of prices. All right?
Yeah. All right, okay. Sir. Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Bali. Keep in touch.
Thank you, brother.
This is Brass Tats. Good afternoon. Brass Tats, good afternoon. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Marie. How are you doing?
Yes, sir. I'm good, yourself?
Not too bad. Yeah, I don't want to be insensitive, nor I don't want to seem to pull down the fact that there is supposed to be protocol in relation to the curfew and so on. But as a business, a person who has a business, one has to look at how one's business survives in an environment. And my business has to do with bread.
Has to do with what?
Selling bread.
You're breaking up, so selling bread?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bread vendor.
Right.
I'm not speaking for myself alone. I'm speaking for a lot of other vendors, because our experience is that bread is not a commodity that sells good during the day from a vendor perspective. Maybe if someone goes to the supermarket, or if someone goes to Purity, maybe they might buy bread or so. But in terms of vending, bread is not a daytime seller, because you have places like restaurants and things open. You have supermarkets open, and those are the places where people go conveniently to get the stuff. And they might buy bread in there, but bread mostly sell it when most places close or coming on to the evening period, when people on their way from work and just don't want to go to the supermarket. And we find ourselves in a situation where, as bread vendors, that we have to open in a similar time to restaurants. And even restaurants have been given more time to continue their business way into the night, whereby we who celebrate have to close off. So, for instance, we have to collect bread, maybe something during the day from the various bakeries. And by, let's say, by 2 o'clock, we might be collecting our bread to set up. as normally we would do, and sell between 2:30 up to about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock in the night time, depending on how things go.
Right.
But in this environment now, where we have the curfew at 6, we have about 2 to 3 hours to sell. So by
what time do you know normally start?
Well, even if we start early, even if we go early, there's no break, there's no sale.
There's no
There's no sale. You just wasting time. And you employ some person to sell $10, and you're going to be paying whatever the rate is at the point in time. Maybe because you just got a little straggler, maybe with somebody coming to buy one item or not, a little item or not. But you don't really get no persistent sale. So our sales pick up in the afternoon.
Isn't that to some extent the nature of business where you don't generally get a continuous stream of clients? It fluctuates. So there are peak periods and there are trough periods.
Well, right, but I'm saying so our peak period is during the evening. I'm saying it is a waste. If you go in the supermarket, people go and they have variety. So therefore, you can get some person spending X amount of money. If you go to a restaurant, people want X or Y. But I'm saying during the midday, people don't go look for bread for food, for lunch. People look for a meal. You have to go very early in the morning, which is complex, when people leave in for work, where people might want a little breakfast or something like that, which means you might have to go on the road and go to different places. And you can get a lot of places to cover a sale. And so therefore, people will find a restaurant during the day. They will leave work, find a restaurant during the day to go and get something to eat. But they ain't going to leave work to go to get bread, that kind of way. Not from
but
a
suppose vendor. suppose you sought to become mobile and take it to their homes. They might not be home, but somebody and the host would know that a bread man is coming through, and therefore we'll buy bread from the bread van if it comes through. Why is that possible? Would COVID allow you to take it to the community? If the clients can't come to you, why don't you seek to find ways to take it to the clients where it's most convenient and most beneficial to you at home, even outside their workplaces?
But this is what I'm saying. There are those people who would drive around and sell. And when you are not accustomed that you go find a new route or you got to infringe on somebody's route, which means it's still going to be complex, but I'm saying generally, even as a vendor, bread is not a day. Anytime between like 10 and 2, bread don't sell. Nobody's at home. And nobody ain't paying attention to bread. I'm telling you that.
What are you proposing? What would you like to see happen then?